Audible has over 100,000 audiobooks available, and you can download one for free over at audibletrial.com/mightymovie. How can you resist that? You can't, so don't. audibletrial.com/mightymovie. Your book is waiting for you. Speaking of waiting, some people can't wait to get out of high school. Some people have never escaped. Director Jason Reitman talks about young adult on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast.
Welcome to Hampton Inn. Do you have a reservation?
No.
Is that a dog in your bag?
No.
We actually allow small pets with a cleaning deposit.
Good, because I have a small dog in my vehicle.
What are you doing back in Mercury? Or you move back, or?
Of course not. Gross.
Psychotic prom queen bitch. Down on the
street and here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage too.
I would keep all of this to yourself. I would find a therapist.
Walk out of her heart. That new baby of his is just darling.
Have you seen it? Up close?
Can I help you find something?
I'm going to a rock concert with an old flame.
Let's show him what he's been missing.
No, he's seen me recently. He knows. But his wife hasn't seen me in a while, so. You can come to the city with me like we always planned.
Mavis, I'm a married man.
No, we can beat this thing together.
Hey, it's MMP, and I'm Dan Persons. Hi there. Trying something new this episode, we've got the press conference with Jason Reitman about his new Diablo Cody scripted movie, Young Adult, the one in which Charlize Theron plays a woman who returns to her hometown to rekindle a high school romance, this despite, or maybe because of the fact that her old flame is now married and has just recently had a baby, and Patton Oswalt serves as her more grounded Greek chorus. And where before we've gone with what I captured with my own recorder, this time we're going with the audio supplied by the studio, which I think you'll agree is much, much better. We'll continue doing that whenever it's available for the rare press conference we run here, but we're all about the exclusive interviews anyway, so this won't happen too often. But here's Jason fielding an interesting variety of questions. Enjoy.
Hi, can you talk about the casting process? Did you have a Charlize captured in mind?
I was only going to make this movie if I could make it with Charlize. I had read the script and I thought it was phenomenal, but I knew how tricky this character was, and I knew how easily it would be to misinterpret this character. You know, on the page, she was written perfectly. She was nuanced and complicated, and she wasn't just some mean girl. She was a woman with deep wounds that, like anybody, wanted to be loved and was searching for her place in life, who really only knew how to find it by going back to high school to the last moment where things kind of made sense to her. But she was looking for an on-road, you know, an on-ramp to the highway. And it's one of those things that in the hands of the wrong actress would just be a mean girl. Her character would just be thin. And I knew Charlize would never judge the character, would make her emotionally complicated, would turn her into a complete human being. And on top of that, Charlize has this great talent that only a few actors have, and I've been able to work with a few actors who have this, where they can change their nature without dialogue. They can change their nature without physicality. It's as if she can dim the light bulb from within, and George knows how to do that, and Ellen knows how to do that. And watching that happen as a director is like magic. And this character could never be done without that great talent. It's easy to look at the final product and go, oh yeah, I kind of see what she's doing, but the amount of kind of pitch perfect acting and pure raw talent that's required to make this character say and do the things that she does and still be vulnerable and human and broken is a very, very rare thing. And there was no reason for me to attempt this movie without her. Sorry, that was a very long answer. And really after that, I just needed Patton Oswalt. I needed someone who was going to be the accessibility point to this movie. And I think this movie works because of Patton Oswalt. I think the audience strangely sees the movie through Patton Oswalt. He says the things that everyone in the audience wants to say, and his rare combination of like brilliant comedy, but also his pathos, his ability to go to these really sad places, makes the whole thing work.
Patton talked about doing table reads before Charlize came into the movie at your house, and that you have a Sunday night movie night where you invite people over and watch movies?
I love when actors talk about my personal life. That's that's great.
Well, it seems to be your work as a filmmaker. We've just been talking about Hugo, where we've heard so much about how Scorsese gives sort of a set of films and homework right. to his cast to get into the movie. Were there other films that you had your cast sort of see or reference with this film?
This is so embarrassing.
And did Patton get the movie because he'd been around from the very beginning?
I love that. Scorsese probably screened these great Italian films for his cast, and the only thing I ever sent Charlize was seasons one of The Hills and Laguna Beach. Oh, yes. Following in the footsteps of giants. I have a movie night at my house every Sunday night, and it really came out of my own embarrassment of the amount of films that I had not seen. And I presumed that if there was a lot of films that I had not seen, that my friends perhaps had not seen them either. So what I did was, every Sunday night, I show a classic movie that you're supposed to have seen that I have not seen. And I just invite my friends and say, hey, here's a moment for us all to stop being embarrassed and start seeing these films. And it started a couple years ago, and we watch films like, and now I'm going to embarrass myself for all of you, Cool Hand Luke, which I had never seen. Patton, I had never seen. Say Anything, I had never seen. I know, that's always the shocker. I had never seen Being There until 2 years ago. I told you, it's humiliating. There are so many great films, and I watched all of Michael Ritchie's films. I hadn't seen Downhill Racer or Smile or Prime Cut or The Candidate. It's a wonderful, it's a wonderful evening for me to kind of share with my friends, where we all get to see those films for the first time as adults, and then we get to talk about them, and Patton has been a regular at that. When I went to do the table read for this film, I called on friends at first, and Patton's a friend, and I said, hey, would you read this role? And watching him do it was just so—he was so perfect. And then when he read it with Charlize, they had this unbelievable chemistry. It was actually the moment I realized this was a romance. I was watching the two of them together, and a heartbreaking romance. It was like Romeo and Juliet, because it's a romance that cannot be. But anyhow, yeah, that's that was the research, and that's how I know Patton.
Standard practice is that once the cameras roll, the writer is out of the picture. How is it different between you and Diablo? And also, have you agreed to help Diablo explore all the phases of her life?
I have the rights to Diablo's life. She... in a deal that really benefits me more than her. I always feel, and I I'm not sure if directors or writers would get more upset at me for saying this, but I feel like they're all part of the same thing. I see my job as storytelling, and that starts with simply an idea, a feeling I want the audience to have, and it travels through writing, directing, shooting, cutting, post, doing this, the whole thing. And so if I don't write the script, I get to personally skip one part of the process. And with Diablo, I don't know, we get along so well and we trust each other so much, it's never been a question of whether or not she was going to be on set. So when she could be on set, it's great. I put her to work, you know. I say, you know, I need this, I need a line, I need a scene, and she does it. But there's also enough trust that if she's not there, she knows I'm not going to screw up her script. And I'm a writer myself. And I strangely feel, as a writer on set, the job is to be a tailor. It's to, and I know, and you know, Sorkin would be pissed if I said this, but if an actor can't say the lines, in my opinion, it's not the actor's fault. If you put on a pair of clothes that don't fit, it's not your fault. It's the clothes' fault. And the clothes should be tailored, and that's how I feel about dialogue. If I'm with an actor and they're struggling with the words, then I tailor the words for the actor. Very rarely would I say, this is the line, you need to say the line. You know, a line in this movie that I would not change is, oh, Sandra, you're good here. Would not change those words. But most of the time, yeah, you find it.
With the possible exception of Juno, a lot of your characters, leading characters, are well skilled in the art of self-deception, and it's none more so than Charlize's character here, in that she has a moment of clarity and then retreats back to the self-deception at the end. I wonder what attracts you to that kind of character in your work.
I would give you a proper answer, but I've deceived myself into a different. think about that. I think everyone deceives themselves. I guess, and I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question correctly, but I like characters that don't change, because I don't think people change. Or they very rarely do, or they do by a tiny percent. I think people have revelatory moments, and they learn things, but most often they don't change off of those things. Or they change for 5 days. The number of times you've gone on a diet for 5 days, or become a vegan for 5 days, or become more conscientious about something, or gone to temple, or whatever it is. We have moments where we think, oh, I should be doing that more. I should call my mother more. And you call your mother for 5 days. But we generally don't make giant change. I remember I told my therapist, I'm in therapy. I'm Jewish. I said, I'm worried that if this works, I won't be a good writer anymore. And he said, don't worry, you're only capable of about 5 or 10% improvement. and I think that's true for people. So that's why Up in the Air ends the way it does, and that's why this movie ends the way it does. They end with people learning things and very well not changing.
Brad?
In light of like your use of dialogue, your brilliant use of dialogue, do you find yourself ever thinking of theater as a medium that you're going to explore further? And how would you see yourself involved with that whole process, directing it as well?
I spent last year in New York making this film from start to finish, including post. And it was a great moment for me, because for the first time in my life, I had seen most of the shows that were playing, and that was really exciting to be able to get into a conversation and actually know what I was talking about for a very brief nanosecond. And certainly looking at great plays made me want to try to direct a play. That said, I know nothing about theater, so it's a little presumptuous of me to think I could do it. But yeah, although on the other hand, what I love about directing movies is I have the final say. You know, I get to cut the performance. And the idea that you just hand off the play to your actors, that seems insane. I mean, I would literally be on stage. Let's do that again. You know, let's just, hold on, audience. And it would be a 10-hour play of just me. All right, one more time. All right, that was great. Continue the scene from there. That could be the play, me directing. It'd be a boring play.
This year we've seen, we saw Bridesmaids and Bad Teacher, and now this movie. It seems like it's a lot of women behaving badly. I wonder, is that something in the zeitgeist, do you think? Or, and also, do you think it's a sign of progress, or is it a step backward? What's your take on it?
I don't know. Women behaving badly is, I'm not trying to be rude, I think is just kind of a cheap term, and... Look, I've always been interested in making movies about women. They interest me far more than men, and I'm interested in honesty in filmmaking. And I think the darker moments are far more interesting than the cheerful ones. And I guess that's my approach. And I don't know why they made Bridesmaids, and I don't know why they made Bad Teacher, but that's certainly why I made this movie.
I had a question about women in this. What was really your message to women? She seems like, as a writer, as a single woman, she's sort of not part of the norm of society. Society doesn't really accept imaginative women on their own who, you know, the square of society. And I was just trying to picture a man in this role and going back to find an old girlfriend. He'd probably be seen as romantic, right? But a woman is sort of pathetic. And I wondered if that was sort of like a message to empower women to try to say, you know, this is what the reality is of, you know, a woman's life, and this is how, you know, we're seen in sort of a way.
Wow, there's a lot in that question. It's a great question. I guess I have a few different answers. So excuse me if I'm all over the road for a moment. First and foremost, I don't have a message in any of my movies. You know, if I have a message, and hopefully there's a continuity of that in all my films, it's think for yourself and come up with your own opinions. And I certainly don't want to tell you what to think. That is the core theme of Thank You for Smoking. And since then, hopefully, people draw their own conclusions. And that's always been kind of the case on Juno. Pro-life people thought it was their movie, pro-choice thought it was theirs, and I've certainly got a variance of opinions of where George Clooney goes at the end of Up in the Air, and that makes me happy. That lets me know I'm doing my job. I really just I'd rather inspire the conversation than tell you what to think. So on this movie, I'm certainly not saying this is my message to women. And as far as how we treat her life, I thought it was a fairly true, and you know, I'm speaking to a room of writers, point of view on what it's like to write, which is it's a really lonely existence, man or woman. Often it feels like a trip to Office Depot makes me feel as though I accomplished something today. I did something, and it's the only, and you do it for the pure reason of if I didn't do this, it really would feel like I did nothing. But I had an adventure. I picked up toner. And being a writer is tricky in that your sense of accomplishment is always so varied. Is it by page count? Is it by that you wrote something special? Will anyone ever read this? Will anyone ever see this? And I don't think that changes no matter how much success you have. Every time I write, I feel like this is awful. No one will ever see this. Or if they do, they'll think it's, you know, they'll never hire me again. So I think Diablo really captured the truth of a writer's life in those first 8 pages, which became the first 8 minutes of this movie. And that got me excited because I don't feel like I've seen it portrayed quite that way, which is alone. It's the sound of the whistling of the wind, you know? It's falling asleep on your sofa in the middle of the day and waking up and thinking that you're never going to amount to anything. I think it was kind of perfect. So that's why the opening is the way it is.
Hi, I have a quick question about, in talking to people who've seen the movie, speaking of being open to interpretation, one of the things that's kind of open to interpretation is the relationship that Charlize Theron's character has with her parents. Mm-hmm. And we see some clues. For instance, you know, they still left her room in the same way when she was a teenager. The wedding picture was still on the wall, even though she's divorced. So can you talk a little bit about what you and or Diablo may have done to sort of explain or any backstory regarding the parents and how she ended up this way, how they may have affected her behavior in the movie that we see?
It's funny, you know, Diablo and I are almost the exact same age, and I think we just are both at that moment in our mid-30s where, you know, for the first time, instead of blaming our parents, we're realizing that we were both probably really difficult to be parents of, and you start to go, oh, God, that's a tough gig being a parent. And we're both also new parents ourselves, so you start thinking, oh, man, that's a tough gig, and maybe they were just trying as hard as they could. And I look at Mavis's parents, and I kind of see the same. They're trying to understand their daughter. They have a difficult, very complicated daughter. And that scene at the dinner table between the three of them, I really love, and I think it's just so well acted across the board. But it is a kind of, you throw your hands up at a certain point. I don't know who to blame at that dinner table, and I kind of like it that way.
But the parents are also kind of focusing on only the good accomplishments of the past, too, aren't they? She just mentioned the photo on the wall and the room the way it is.
Right.
They kind of want to keep her.
Yeah, I guess there's two interpretations. There's one is that have they kept her in her childhood the way, you know, the child of a beauty pageant kid would be? Or they really just want her to be happy, and they're like trying to focus on the positive, and their poor daughter is just, you know, just constantly negative. And I don't know. I look at the parents and I kind of see both sides of them. I see them as really trying hard with a really difficult child. And yet I know what you mean. And I think my favorite line of that scene is the Charlize saying, "Mom, I think I'm an alcoholic." Huh. You're so funny.
Diablo said that you haven't made a film that was less than great, which was a nice compliment.
That's really nice of her.
And I think that one of the things that I appreciate about your films that stands out is your ability to navigate a really fun comedy. You've got all these great laughs that a comedy has, but you have like this heartfelt, deep, dramatic soul of a story and characters. And my question really is, as a director, how do you mesh those things together? Like, how do you find the right tone, the right connection between those things? Is it something that, I'll just let you answer.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, thank you for saying those really kind things. That means a lot to me. Fuck, that's nice to hear. Sorry, I just did an interview earlier where I was just talking about how I became a director, and I just remember a moment where I thought, I'll be lucky if I ever get to direct a commercial, and it's a really cool thing to hear. Thank you for saying that. I think, I've been really lucky. I've worked with great writers, whether they be authors or screenwriters, and I've worked with brilliant actors, and all of them make me look far more talented than I am. And when it comes to tone, look, I think there's certain things I'm good at, and there's certain things I'm not so good at. And I think I have pretty good pitch. And when I think of a story, the second I read it, it appears to me as it's in a key, like a song would be in, you know, the key of C. And I have a pretty good sense when I'm watching a performance or reading words or even looking at a location or a piece of wardrobe. Does that feel like it's in the key of C, or is that off? Is it just C minor? Or is it, oh my God, that's an A, we got to do something about that. And what I've tried to develop over the films is an ability to convince people to get back into C. I don't know. I hope that didn't seem like a cheap answer, but it's like anything. When you're doing it, you're just doing it. And it's only in times like this that you look back and try to figure out, all right, what was I doing when I wrote this or directed this? And I guess that's the way I make sense out of it right now. It's It's about pitch. And that doesn't apply to comedy or drama, because that work is already done in the writing. It's not the job on set to be funny. It's not your job in editing to be funny. Funny happens, drama happens in the writing. After that, it's about tonal control. It's about how do you manipulate the audience to feel the thing you want them to feel.
Speaking about tone, was there ever, obviously this character is quote unquote ugly or dark. Was there ever any point in thinking or hesitation of, like, about tone and dialing it, like dialing it forward, dialing it back? Is she ever too, is she too ugly? Do we need to, you know what I mean? Like about the increments of like where we're taking this character and how far we go.
Right. I mean, obviously there was a couple times where on set, she would say something that was so mean that we just had to cut the line of dialogue, because it was just, at that point, it wasn't even interesting anymore. It was just, that's really bitchy. I mean, you can't, you know, the audience is just going to hate her for no reason. And it all of a sudden is actually out of character and dishonest, because it's just so mean. It's mean for no reason. All of this always goes back to a piece of advice that my father gave me, and he literally gave it to me the night before I started shooting Thank You for Smoking. And he said, always remember, it's not your job to be funny. Your barometer for comedy is nowhere as good as your barometer for truth. And the only thing you're trying to achieve on set is honesty. You look at a performance, you look at anything, the way people interact, the location, the way you're shooting it. Does it feel truthful? Because you're not going to be able to tell if it's funny. Every once in a while, it's like, okay, that's hilarious. But you always know when it feels like bullshit or not, even with people. You know when they're being truthful with you. And so it's the greatest piece of directing advice I've ever gotten, and it feeds everything. And if I'm ever unsure, I can always go back to that and think about what my father told me and say, all right, does this feel honest? And that plays into, is this too mean? Because if it's so mean that it feels otherworldly, then it's not right.
Both this movie and Juno was set in Minnesota, and up near, it's also set, I think, in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Do you love those towns as opposed to LA or the big cities?
I don't know why. Look, I grew up in Beverly Hills, but for some reason, I feel very comfortable in the Midwest. I can't explain it. Maybe my parents need to tell me something. I don't know. But I love the Midwest. I love being in Minnesota. I love being in St. Louis. I love being in Detroit. I love being in Omaha, although that's technically the Plains. And they're specific about that. But yeah, I really like shooting there. I like the people there. I feel very at home there. And I enjoy the fact that three of my four movies are set there. And I hope to make more movies there.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Hey.
Teenage Fan Club? I don't know them. I love the song, I think. Talk about the music in the film, please.
You know, one of the great parts about working with Diablo is that she's so specific in her writing. Production design, wardrobe, as specific as her dialogue seems, the description work is even stronger. And the songs are there. And so the only question there is then, you know, do I agree with them or not? And I usually agree with them. And on this movie, even though we love the same music and we come from the same era, there's a few songs that I'm not a huge fan of, including the Teenage Fan Club song, but I knew it was right for the movie, so that's kind of all that mattered.
What's the name of that song?
The concept.
In a story like this, I think we're always sort of waiting for the inevitable public meltdown scene. And I was struck in watching it by how you go to that beat, but it seemed to me push past it and go for a scene that's much more sort of raw and honest and emotional than the sort of construction might lead us to. And I just wondered if you could talk a little more about that particular scene, if that's something that like came out in the first draft the way that is, or if it's something you and Diablo worked a lot on.
That scene and the two scenes that follow it, the scene, the sex scene with Charlize and Patton, and then the breakfast table scene with Charlize and Colette Wolfe, are the three scenes that made me want to make this movie. I think if you had just showed me the first two acts of the screenplay, I'd have been like, nah, this seems like a great script. But what you realize when you get to the third act of this movie is that the first two acts are really there to set you up for those three scenes. like a magic trick. And you are set to believe she's a certain type of character with a certain type of past, that you were in a certain type of tonal experience in a certain type of movie, and then you hit these three scenes and they blindside you. And that's how I felt when I read the script, and that's how I wanted the audience to feel when they saw the movie. I wanted them to be uncomfortable. I wanted people to cringe. I wanted to do something that I hadn't done in my other films. And I think as a director, I try to grow with each film. I try to do something different to the audience. In the first movie, I just wanted to make people laugh. Second film, I wanted them to feel romance. On the third film, I wanted them to feel lonely. And on this one, I wanted people to feel uncomfortable. I wanted them to look at the screen and be so in the moment that they felt like they were standing there on the lawn watching Charlize break down right in front of them, and they don't know what to say because you feel sorry for her. You're not sure if you're part of the cause of this. It's just so uncomfortable. And the writing was so good and the acting was so good that we did it in two takes. I remember just watching the monitor with, you know, everyone else, and it's one long shot. It's all handheld. And we just applauded. At the end, I remember I went to Charlize after, and I said, all right, you got it. And she goes, oh, come on, really, two takes? She said, you made me do six takes of opening a door last week. Really, I get two takes of this? I was like, I don't know what you want. You got it. It's done. The way she did the nice sweater line, it's just, I don't know where that came from. It was just perfect. But that was always the intention. The intention was to set the audience up for two acts and then to hit them with that scene. And then do another reversal in just the same way that you said you're not ready for that scene. You don't expect it to reach that level of dark honesty and pathos. The Sandra scene is just as much of a surprise. She sits down for breakfast. You think, okay, this is the scene where she learns something. She becomes a better person. She gets in the car. She's going to go do something. She's going to go work for the Red Cross or something. I don't know. And Sandra says, you can't change, and convinces her not to, and the movie ends. I remember reading the script and thinking, what a spectacular ending. If we can do this, this would be phenomenal. And that's why I did it.
One of the things that I like so much about the film was how ordinary people are portrayed. They're not idiots. They're worthwhile. Mm-hmm. They're worth knowing. And they're happy for the most part. I just was wondering what your observations are of rich, like, successful people and their altercations or, you know, just their meeting of ordinary people. Like, do they feel sorry for them because they don't live the glamorous life, or do they wish they could have some of these values or experiences?
I don't think I know how to answer that question. I think every person is different. And I've seen rich people be complete assholes, and I know rich people who are some of the loveliest and compassionate people I've ever met. So as much as one would think that wealth and circumstance turns you into a good or bad person, it seems to be a combination of other things, and I've had people on both sides of the spectrum treat me in both ways, at both extremes. I know with my films, I don't want to judge anybody. I don't want to judge any of the characters. It's very important to me. If the audience feels as though they know how my judgment of a character, then I considered, then I think I failed. I think my job at the end of the day is to create honesty and truth and real moments that, instead of telling you to think, just push you to think about something. And nothing gets me more excited than an audience arguing over what I was trying to say or having just a thoughtful conversation about the film rather than walking out. I'd be much more disappointed by someone walking out of my film and thinking, and now I believe this, because that strangely isn't my job.
And how do you stay grounded with all your success?
Yeah, who says I'm grounded? That's really kind of you, and I suppose my parents did a really good job.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, Audible does have a variety of young adult novels, but I think you'd be more interested in Candy Girl, A Year in the Life of an Unlikely Stripper, the book that introduced Diablo Cody to the world. The audiobook is available for a free download along with a free 14-day trial membership at audibletrial.com/mightymovie. Or if you just want to go back to explore the twisted ecology of high school, maybe you'd be interested in Hannah Friedman's Everything Sucks, Losing My Mind and Finding Myself in a High School Quest for Cool, or Alexandra Robbins' The Geeks Shall Inherit the Earth, Popularity, Quirk Theory, and Why Outsiders Thrive After High School. There are just a couple more of the over 100,000 audiobooks available, all playable on iPod, iPad, iPhone, Android, or Droid, MP3 player, and on and on. audibletrial.com/mightymovie. You can't get the deal just by going to the regular site, so please remember that URL, audibletrial.com/mightymovie. And Young Adult opened on December 16th and is playing nationwide. You can see the trailer and get the link to the official website at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you want to write me, the email address is dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. And next week, remember how I said we'd rarely be doing press conferences? Well, guess what? Got another one for you. Next week, Steven Spielberg and company will be answering questions about the adventures of Tintin. It'll be mostly Spielberg. That's the way it goes. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2011, Dan Persons, all rights reserved. No unauthorized duplication permitted.